KaiserNetwork.org.
Please welcome our panelists for this morning. Please welcome our panelists for this morning, starting with His Highness Sheikh Salman bin Hamad Al Khalifa, Crown Prince and Commander-in-Chief of the Bahrain Defense Force, Richard Sizek of the National Association of Evangelicals, Vartan Gregorian of the Carnegie Corporation of New York. And please welcome this morning's moderator, Zain Berji of CNN.
Good morning, everyone, again. There are plenty of empty tables, two, one over there, so please just move in. Good morning. This is going to be another very interesting, exciting day. It's a long day, so be ready for it. One reminder, if you have questions as it goes along, just write them down, pass them to your table facilitators, and that will help us for the second half. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, it's lovely to see everyone here this morning. Welcome to our panel today on mitigating religious and ethnic conflicts. My name, as you heard, is Zain Berji. It's an absolute pleasure to be here with such a distinguished group of panelists also. You know, we're told by many pundits and commentators that what we're witnessing is a term of Samuel Huntington, a phrase that he coined, a clash of civilizations. But the question I want to pose to all of us here today, is that what we are really seeing? How much of this so-called clash is fueled by religion, by ethnicity, by ignorance? Is it also fueled by territory over resources? Is it fueled by perceived national interests? Over confusions, essentially, about culture and about identity and essentially how we see each other. Those are some of the things I want to discuss with our panelists today, and I would love for any input that we have from the audience as well. I want to start by discussing how we can have a dialogue of civilizations. There have been times in history when people have been able to live side by side in a way that is peaceful and that has promoted security in their regions. I want to start by introducing Reverend Richard Sizek, as we did a moment ago. And I'd like to start by asking you, how do you see the East-West divide? How do you explain the massive gap that exists between the Islamic world and the West?
I get asked this question a lot. I once confronted Samuel Huntington himself and had said that a panel ought to be organized, this was now 10 years ago, on the subject of religion and foreign policy. It was picked up by a man by the name of Elliot Abrams, who at the time, you'll know that name, was at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And he invited Huntington, I'm getting there to answer that question, Zain, by saying that, amazing, here we were just 10 years ago, if I have my dates correct, and the very first conference being held on the subject of religion and foreign policy. Isn't that amazing? And I would say that we are like Robert Wutnow described once at an American Academy of Religion meeting. He said, and he was speaking in this case just of Americans, he said, we are standing in an elevator, Christians, Jews, Muslims, and others, pretending as if somebody else isn't there, though we know they are, and not having the slightest idea how to talk to them. That's how he described it, just for Americans. Now, I would say, imagine the task internationally, because religion forms in this country, as it does elsewhere, our politics, our policy, our identity, and our culture. And that's how important it is And unless we get beyond these perceptions and misperceptions, beyond the history, beyond the ideologies that separate us, then we're in trouble.
Vartan Gregorian, what about that? How do we get beyond that?
Well, I'm the living proof of fusion of civilizations, not conflict of it. I'm the living embodiment of fusion of civilizations rather than clash of civilizations. I was born in Tabriz. I'm an Armenian background. So my first encounter with Azeris, therefore I had to learn Turkish. The second encounter was Iranian official schools. I had to learn Persian. Then the Soviets came. I had to learn Russian. And then Soviets left. We had to go back to a Persian school. But one thing dominated. I saw everything from below. I met Jews. I met Persians. I met Kurds. I met Azeris. I met Russians. And then I met American missionaries. And I met American soldiers, British missionaries, Soviet soldiers. What I'm trying to say, I had a microcosm of humanity as I grew up. So to me, clash of civilizations was cultural values, and now you accommodate each other. During Ramadan, we as Christians did not eat in the street. We had the right to eat. We did not eat as a kind of respect for the Muslims. Muslims, when there were a Christian funeral, took their hats off in honor of the dead. So, but at the same time, I also saw we count everything in terms of Muslim and Christian. The ants, big ants, were black ants, were Muslim ants. Yellow ants were small, helpless Christian ants, and so forth. So that's the kind of background I came from. And I was 15, I went to Lebanon to have to learn French and encounter French culture. But I'm saying all of this to come to answer your question. When I grew up, there were no clash of civilization because there were no civilization. There was only one civilization. And Persians and Arabs and the turtle Tamaddon. Tamaddon was civilization. Each nation, each one brought their gift to the table of civilization. Each culture was a contributing stream to the civilization. It's later that I found out that there was discussion by Oswald Spengler, Civilizations Rise and Die, Toynbee, 26 Civilizations, and Ethel Huntington, Clash of Civilizations. And I published a book, Islam, a Mosaic, Not a Monolith. And Mr. Huntington objected to that he'd never used the term monolith. But that's a fact that we cannot categorize because, since we have Reverend here, I cite Bishop Pike. When I was at Stanford, I heard the most moving speech by Episcopal Bishop of California. He said, categorization is sin. The moment you categorize, you're able to dehumanize. And the moment that you categorize, you're able to stereotype people. And as a result, I've been always conscious and always sensitive not to categorize. It's out of categorization that's come Islamophobia. It's out of categorization that's come anti-Semitism. It's out of categorization that's come anti-Christian or anti-Buddhist or anti-any kind of thing. So when we say clash of civilizations or East-West, I always see variations of it because last time when East-West existed, the Byzantine Empire and the Roman Empire, East-West. And also, I have to mention this other sensitive issue. Whenever we try to foment struggle or fight among kids, a policeman came because whenever Armenians won football game in Tabriz, we had to run because we'd be beat up. But we try to inject religion into it that he offended Prophet Muhammad. And we said, no, he offended Prophet Isa, Christ. Policemen slapped both of us. He said, get the hell out of it. Because nobody wanted to deal with that issue. That was such a sensitive issue that everyone, from teacher to others, wanted to teach you that these are not easy things, insults you can hurl against Christians, against Jews, and not without consequences. And that's what I want to say about that.
Well, let's bring that to today, just over the past few weeks. And, Your Highness, I'd like you to address this. When we look at the words that the Pope said recently, for example, in Germany, you know, quoting the Byzantine emperor, the 14th century Byzantine Empire, and his remarks on Islam and the Prophet, even the cartoon controversy that happened earlier this year, and the kind of reaction it fomented in the Arab and Muslim world. How do you explain that, about how it's perceived and why it's reacted to that way?
Well, good morning, everyone. As you can see, I drew the short straw in the green room. No, I can explain it as well as...
But you're a tall man.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Obviously, I think those remarks were not intended to cause the reaction that they did. Now, the Holy See has a policy of not being quite as open, as say, or as malleable as a regular politician. So the apology that was issued was, I think, unprecedented in papal history. So this is should be accepted by most people as a very generous and decent thing to do, and I certainly do. Why the reaction? Well, I think it was insensitive, and I think that the way that the Pope had addressed the issue of the Prophet, peace be upon him, Muhammad, really offended quite a lot of people. I mean, there are issues central in any culture to the identity of, or the soul, if you will, of any one group. It could be iconography, it could be a person, it could be a name, it could be a historical event. And if we are to understand one another, I think we really need to understand each other's symbols and understand each other's issues in a way that transcends our own. Because certainly in any dialogue between any group of people, the first thing that needs to be understood is that we are all equals. There are no better or worse people in any respectable dialogue. Really, there are very few right and wrong answers. There are compromises that are reached in agreement with two differing views. So I, of course, am appalled by some of the reaction that you see from some small individuals, some very angry individuals. Of course, there have been some very unfortunate events, and I actually am very sorry that those have occurred in the name of Islam, because they certainly don't represent the Islam that I believe in. And as far as the cartoons or the Danish cartoons, again, I think that comes from a real lack of understanding of the significance of some of the main symbols that are important to a Muslim. So, again, this in no way excuses any of the awful or atrocious or evil things that were done in response to those things. And I think really what we must do when we see things like this is double our efforts to try and explain to the world what is important to us, but yet at the same time recognize what is important to the world and respect that in return.
And often doing it through direct dialogue. Reverend, I know that you've been involved in some of your own work personally, speaking to extremists on the other side, dialoguing with them directly. Can you give us a sense of your experiences and what we can draw from that?
Yes, let me answer that by asking the Crown Prince, Your Highness, this question. It was raised in Time magazine. The Pontiff has a point. Let me ask you the question that Jeff Israeli asks. He says, the essential question, referring now to the Pope, he said was this: is this conviction that acting unreasonably contradicts God's nature always and intrinsically true? And this is a question you see not reserved only for the Islamic world. It's for we as Christians as well. And so I think that the reason, Zane, I got into the challenge of this interfaith dialogue is because I was willing to challenge myself and challenge my community. And that is not always easy. And yet I apparently have a flaw in my character. It just means I go for the difficult ones.
So tell us
and
about
And somebody that. Said, Richard, you could be on that climate change panel, but never, let's not go there. The point is this. I want to challenge my community, you see, not just to tolerance, which is an acceptance and a respect for the other, for you and others, Your Highness. It's not just tolerance. It's to go beyond tolerance to principled pluralism in this country, which for My definition means no religion has a privileged place. And I guess for an evangelical to say that is controversial in my community. But I believe it. I believe in principled pluralism. And from there, I would say one step even further, which is to say partnership. Partnership which acknowledges that God can actually work through other people and other faiths to accomplish his purposes in the world, and that that is intentional on his part, and that I don't need to be threatened by that.
So when you're meeting and dialoguing face-to-face with people that one may refer to as extremists, well, take us into the
okay.
room with
Here,
you.
I mean, you here's know, an like, example.
Tell us like, the conversations.
Yes. Here is an example. We had begun a dialogue in Morocco, and I had made a number of visits. In the meantime, prior to going over with an anticipated delegation, an American evangelist goes to Morocco, and he had asked me, should I go? And I said, well, only if you go quietly, and if it's for the purpose of service, humanitarian service, and do not call the press, please, and leave quietly. But if you are interested in service, not evangelism, then go. Well, one of his well-intentioned friends alerted him to the press. There were big articles. Evangelicals were now coming into Morocco. And you can imagine the reaction. So I went over, Zane. I went over to meet. And here's what happened. I met the PJD party. Now, these are my co-religionists in the sense these are the quote-unquote conservative Islamists, if you want to use that term. Not really Islamists, but they are the strongest-willed and rising political party in Morocco. And in meeting with them across the table, there was a common sense that if American evangelicals can dialogue with the PJD party, Iskotal and other parties in Morocco, then truly we can have a dialogue. But in the meantime, you see, what had happened was the press had gotten this story that, well, the evangelicals were coming to Morocco. Well, you can imagine that. But in face-to-face dialogue, then and subsequently, I truly believe that we have a meeting of the minds. A meeting of the minds at least to say that we need that partnership that I've described. To go beyond tolerance, to go beyond even this principled pluralism which we accept in this country, which I would frankly like to teach overseas, to a partnership that says there is something so much at stake here that if we do not engage with one another face to face, so that I am seeing you in ways I didn't see you, and you are seeing me in ways you didn't see me. That if we do that, as a poet by the name of William Stafford said, not only will the prevailing other models prevail, not only will these outside models of violence prevail, you see, but we will have a meeting of the minds.
Yes, I'd like Vartan to weigh in on this. I mean, we're talking about partnership, pluralism, tolerance, the successful projects that you've been engaged with. But the reality, too, today, Vartan, on the ground, is that the majority of people in this world, particularly, you know, as we see it becoming more and more polarized over politics and ideology and religion, don't see each other that way. It's more a clash of ignorance, if anything else, and a fear of the other and the unknown. How do you transcend that and bring it down to the reality on the ground today?
What surprises me that in all of this discussion about the Pope, there was no mention of Vatican II, what John Paul II did, the fact that there had been so much mileage covered in terms of including Muslim community around the world after all this century of casting them aside, including in human race, and not only here, but in afterlife as well, and so forth. It's maybe small to some of you, but it was a big deal. When Khatami met in Vatican with Pope John Paul II, there were many manifestos issued and so forth. Not a single newspaper provides context. Second, the clash exists now, this division and misconceptions, because we have lots of ignorance about history. Even in our United States, we live in an ahistorical age. Lots of ignorance about history, lots of ignorance about religions, including among Christians. Once I asked eight denominations, all of them believe in Christ. Well, if you believe in, what does separate you? They could not say it. We are Methodist, you're Lutheran, but we don't know what separate us, Presbyterian, Evangelical. They could not. What surprises me, during Renaissance and Reformation, Luther was sponsored, for example, by German princes, and others were sponsored by the emperor. Politicians used religion to advance secular goals. Now, all over the world, religious establishments are using secular power to advance religious goals. That's fine. It's their right to do. But there is no theological debate. Theologians of all sorts, including insignificant ones who have no standing, issue a fatwa, a legal opinion, and all of a sudden, everybody takes Islam thinks that way. What has surprised me is not politicians and others who engage in this, but why theologians are not involved in discussion. Muslim theologians amongst themselves, Christian theologians among themselves, to try to reduce division point. And that's one of the key issues. If you want something constructive, the first thing I would do is introduce cultural geography, cultural anthropology, people to know where people live, what they believe, what they have in common with us. Not too many people know that Abraham is the founder of three faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. That the reason Muslims cannot make fun of Jews and fun of Christian patriarchs, because all of them are their prophets. They could not make fun of Moses. They cannot make fun of Abraham, Isaiah, and go on. Or Jesus, Isa. But people don't know, including Muslims, don't know their history. They may know the Quran, but they don't know their history. They don't know that the entire history of Islam, and forgive me for saying this, there has not been a single act of unity. Three successors of Prophet Muhammad were assassinated. There are many centers, divisions of Islam, from Cordoba to Baghdad to Damascus to Delhi to Isfahan later to Cairo. And so we don't know their differences. It's easy to lump. It's easy together. It's easy to generalize. It's easy to condemn, but not know. So lack of knowledge, you're absolutely right. It's clash of ignorances because politicians pick up what theologians or religious leaders are saying and kept running, but religious leaders stay behind the scenes. They're never challenged, and so that's my point. There should be more theological dispute. I'm against it in a Renaissance time, and for it now. If I were had a chance, I would put all the Muslim and Christian theologians as world's greatest figures on the Time magazine cover and all of them. Let them debate each other. Let them show their knowledge and ignorance. We don't know on what basis they make their pronouncements. The Pope, we're going line by line analyzing it. I have not seen a similar analysis of Muslim or other theological disputes. Which line was taken from Prophet Muhammad saying? Which one was taken from Al-Biruni? Which one taken from there? They don't do it. If you don't do it, then sloganeering becomes the dominant theme. And that's what we're doing. We issue slogans and people pick up and fight, but nobody questions the essence of it. So I'm welcome to questioning of the Pope, but I like at the same time question all the other statements are made with equal analysis, equal vehemence if need be, on the part of the same people if somebody distorted Prophet's saying or the Spirit and the Quran and so forth.
And the media loves slogans, and we pick up on that and lead with that all the time. Your Highness, I wonder if you can also add to that. Where are the Muslim theologians? Where are the Muslim moderates? Why is it that in the Arab and Muslim world, it's the extremists that once were the fringe appear to be taking center stage, and very little among the Muslim leadership is being said and done about it that's effective?
Are you sure?
That's effective.
Well, if you continue to focus on 10 guys with slogans that say death to America and all the rest of it, or some extremist terrorist group like Al-Qaeda, which is much more serious than the 10 guys with the slogan, then you will, of course, think that the whole Islamic world is just full of a bunch of maniacs. But if you look to things like the Saudi Riyadh Declaration or the Amman Declaration or the Grand Mufti of the Kaaba, the Masjid al-Haram, speaking out against racial intolerance, religious intolerance, when you look at what the statements that we make all the time discussing this issue, then you can start to see that, yes, there are, and what must also be noted is that the Islamic world is not a monolith. It is a mosaic. And there are many nations in the Islamic world. There are 22 Arab nations in the Arab world alone. If you add in all the other Islamic countries, it's much greater than that. So if you were to look in Malaysia at what they're doing to combat extremism, or Indonesia, or as far away as Morocco, you would start to see that there are people engaged, as in politics, which is all local, religion is all local. I mean, the relationship that a human being has with the spiritual world is delivered through a learned person, and that learned person is either a priest or a mufti or a rabbi, at least in our parts of the world. And it is important to educate those people on the message that they deliver. Let me just give you an example of an existing dialogue or deepening of dialogue between civilizations. The relationship that my country has with the United States started in 1889, and it started with a group of missionaries who are still there today. And they started operating a hospital, and it's called the American Mission Hospital. That's 100 years ago. That is, you know, one of the oldest foreign relations links this country has, probably with a number of countries around the world. So they are free to practice their religion. They are free to discuss with local citizens the beliefs that they have. Some people have converted. We don't mind this. This is something that goes on in Bahrain. They have served a very important role in healing the sick. In fact, when the hospital ran into problems, the whole community gathered together in a fund charity drive to provide equipment and a new building. So I don't believe that we can just reduce this whole debate to slogans or perceptions or media hype. I really think that you need to go to the community, you need to talk to the people, and it starts by winning people one by one. So and not judging, really. That is the really important thing.
Let me pick up on that and to say that when evangelical evangelists, and believe me, there's a difference between the two. Evangelical is the broad term for the movement, of which, for those outside America, is by Gallup and others' estimation, 25% of the general public, could be as high by recent surveys just in the last Washington Post, 47% saying they are Bible-believing. But anyway, you're talking about a quarter of the public. When some of the evangelists in that broad community after 9/11, Your Highness, came out and described Islam in terms that were derogatory, the National Association of Evangelicals convened a meeting in Washington, and a consultation on Islam in which missiologists, pastors, scholars, and others came forward with a statement that resonated when it was released around the world, which said, "We challenge our community not to talk this way."
Thank you.
Welcome. You're welcome. And it's in large measure, it stopped. Not always, but you have to confront, even as you said, individuals face to face.
Yes.
And some of that continues. And some of those who use that language, I would suggest, unbeknownst to most of you here, are becoming pariahs in our own movement. Why? I say amen. Why? You see, because you can't talk that way. There is a private language of faith. There's a public language of citizenship. And a friend of mine, Abu Patel, says, well, we need as well a public language of faith. Well, I say we came out with a public language, a statement, you see, for civic engagement. And surveys show that in those communities where there is violence that exists between faith groups, it's preceded by a lack, a dearth, an absence completely often of the links of engagement, you know, interfaith links of engagement that help alleviate mitigate that. And so I think resolving this conflict, by the way, I told Samuel Huntington, I said, you don't understand evangelicals. He said, you're right, I don't. I said, you don't understand evangelicals. And consequently, you pose a paradigm that operates inconsistently with what even our gospel teaches, namely that we are pessimists intent on a conflict that never ends with others with others in the Muslim world. And I said, that's not evangelicalism.
His Highness made a very important point about diversity of Muslim world, if we can call Muslim world. We don't call it Christian world. If we call it Muslim world, Muslim countries is my preference. But second will be that we always go after the loud noises rather than after sane noises. Even in the United States, Farrakhan dominated United States media because of anti-Semitic rubbish statements and anti-Catholic and so forth. Walid, the son of Elijah Muhammad, with 500,000 followers in Chicago, never makes the papers. He's head of a Sunni group, never makes the papers because he does not utter those things. So we have to be able also to show the other face of Islam, Muslim communities around the world, where people live together, where utterances are challenged. And as far as I'm concerned, it would be great if Evangelical published this in all Arab papers, front page, full page. You'll be more propaganda that way for evangelicals than any issuing for American audiences does not help. We have also to challenge the rest of the world to read where you stand, because they don't understand the diversity of American evangelicals. They categorize us as we, by necessity or ignorance, categorize them and us.
We're going to take a short break for now, and I'd like to invite everyone here to jot down your questions if you haven't already, and when we come back, we'll pose them to our panelists.
If I could just, you know the drill, but you see the question that's on the screen. Let me just refine it a little bit. I think this was a fantastic discussion. Now you should challenge the panelists through what you're going to be discussing to come up with really concrete steps that you think can be taken to address the problems that were identified. And again, you know, take the opportunity. You're at tables where you have a mixture of people. Be shameless. If there's somebody there who you think could support one of your programs and you have an idea that comes up, use this opportunity. That's what this is about. So the question is what different institutions can do, school, universities, religious institutions, to bridge this divide. Two technical comments. The first is there's still some pretty empty tables. Let's try to consolidate the tables, because otherwise here there's going to be a one-person discussion down there, and that may not be the best. And the second thing, apparently they've added a category. I don't know what this means, but for the facilitators there's a category called other, to put other comments. I'm sure the facilitators understand that better than I do, but anyway, have a good discussion. Oh, thank you. That was great.
Hi, Madeline.
How are you, darling?
Back to the stage. And, of course, please welcome our moderator, Ms. Burgi. Thank you. Thank you. May we have a round of applause welcoming back our panel and our moderator, please.
I think we're ready to start again. We've got some excellent questions from everyone here in the audience. Thank you. We only have about 9 minutes, so I'll request our panelists to keep your answers short so my questions can go long. One question that we have here that, Your Highness, perhaps I'd like you to address. Why keep focusing only on Islam? After all, there's a clash of civilizations within all religions right now. And that's something I think is important, sort of the differences within Islam that you have addressed already. But how do you see that? And how important is it to address the differences within?
While that's very true, I think we must always respect the fact that there is a lot of fear generated about Islam these days. So the more we can do to dispel that fear about having that conversation with Muslims and Jews and Christians and Buddhists and Hindus and whoever, the better. I agree with you. I mean, there are lots of differences among many of the religions and many of the communities around the world. But I stand ready to discuss and to expose myself as a young Muslim who is internationally globalized, for lack of a better term, to the rest of you to show you that, you know, that there are people on the other side trying to do the right thing.
Reverend, can you weigh in on that too? What about the dialogue within more within the Christian evangelical movement as well, where one perhaps may consider examining their own differences?
Oh, absolutely. The biggest change is a change in attitude that it's occurring in the leadership of the evangelical movement, away from, if you will, some call it the religious right or the right wing. I prefer to call them corner dwellers. These are people who, in an echo chamber, talk to themselves. And so the biggest change is a total change in attitude. Unfortunately, the reality is that by surveys, 37% admit a prejudice against Muslims. 37% admit it. And that is what we have to address in our movement and what we are aiming to do through lots of programs here and abroad, and we can go there.
Fertan, we talk about programs, but I also want to talk about policy. Even though there's the dialogue on the one hand, there is successful initiatives, as we've talked about as well. But when you look at the Middle East, for example, in the region, and U.S. policy in that region, when you talk to a lot of Arabs and Muslims, they say the center of the problem is U.S. policy and support for Israel. How do you view that in terms of the context of what you're trying to achieve, a dialogue of civilizations where policy in the region tends to create more of a divide?
Unfortunately, the Arab-Israeli issue or Palestinian-Israeli issue is one of the more vexing problems. In this country, there is no clear dialogue in a sense. There are statements because everybody is cautious. The best dialogue I have ever seen happening on these issues in Israel. And I would have loved to have this conference in Israel. We would have gotten many more diverse views than anywhere else, number one. Number two, I want to mention one thing that we are, last night I was with President Ahmadinejad at the Council on Foreign Relations, and this is, again, a very polarized issue because the issue is not, I have to be brief, the issue is not reality alone, the issue is on a perception. And let me go back to one issue. Iran, I've taken as an example, has 1.5, 2 centuries great relation with the United States. the first nation to be given one other than Morocco, most favorite nation treaty arrangement was Iran, 1856. Missionaries there did not convert anyone, maybe one or two, one in 1.5 centuries. But they educated lots of Iranians and established modern hospitals and so on. And then, coming back, we have to accept that during a Mossadegh period, that goes back in the case of Iran, we made a mistake in cooperating with Ayatollah Kashani, which religious leaders in Iran don't want to mention him. Ayatollah Kashani conspired to overthrow Mossadegh, so did army, so did monarchists, so did we, because we were worried about the Cold War communist takeover of Iran. The same way now, we judge everybody in terms of category and ideologically. So if we accept that we made a mistake, if we had not overthrown Mossadegh, maybe Iran will be in a nationalist and secular Iran and would have accomplished things they want. But we don't discuss this thing because it always comes to the issue of guilt, admitting mistake, apologizing, and so forth, rather than explaining. In the case of the other thing, perception, I think one of the important things is how to bridge the gap between, not politicians, again, that's coming, between intellectual class of Arabs and Muslims, and religious leaders of Muslims and Christians. Today, I did not see a single Muslim theologian, maybe there are, theologian from old school to be here. Those are the people we need to engage.
What needs to be done to bridge that gap, though?
Well, bridge quiet diplomacy first, not public debate. Quiet discussion, one-on-one, group speed, track two. Our corporation has track two with North Korea, track two with Iran. Namely, for 10 years, we talk on every issue. If something comes up, you don't have to go to 0 point. In the same kind of track two that happened in South Africa, I was told by Ibrahim Lakhdari that it took 5 years of negotiations between Mandela in jail and Leclerc on everything, the size of the flag, the national anthem, Howard Constitution, property rights, everything before they concluded. But we're impatient. We would like everything to be solved immediately to the satisfaction of all. And that's not possible. So therefore, I advocate dialogue between Israelis and Arabs, between Israelis and Muslims, between Christians and Muslims, not in open, advertised, but quietly, in order to find common ground.
Let me follow up. Walter Russell Mead, in a piece I would recommend this month called God's Country, subtitled The Evangelicals, says the most important dialogue that needs to occur is between evangelical Christians and Muslims. That's what he says. And he says it's not the fundamentalists, you see, who have a pessimistic... You want to know the difference between the evangelicals and the fundamentalists. The fundamentalists have a pessimistic view of the future, and they have this perception, unlike evangelicals and liberal Christians, that there's an unbridgeable divide between the believer and the unbeliever. So you put together, you see, those two factors. No wonder the Left Behind series has the General Secretary of the UN as the Antichrist. Now, that is really craziness. But you see, that combination of pessimism and that unbridgeable divide by the fundamentalists is really what has disenfranchised, you see, evangelicals from the bigger conversation, because people think we believe that. We don't believe that. We believe, as Mead points out, there's a common ground that evangelicals have with the rest of the world, especially Muslims, that we need to take advantage of, and yet we're excluded because, well, we're perceived as, well, those crazies over there.
Johannes?
I could say the exact same thing about some of the fundamentalists in my religion. So, I agree. You know, it's not us. It's them. Let's keep those guys on the fringes. Let's talk.
Okay.
a number of questions, actually, from you all have been about the media. What kind of role can the media play in promoting dialogue and in being a lot more responsible? I'd like to hear very quickly one thought from each one of you, what the media can do better that it's not doing. Reverend.
Don't go to the voices who represent themselves. I'm absolutely convinced the media puts voices, I don't need to say their names, on CNN or Fox News, because they want almost to pigeonhole us, to put us in a box. Oh, well, they're entertaining. Well, I'm tired of that kind of entertainment. I would like serious discussion from real people who have real constituencies that must be engaged on this issue, or we're in big trouble. The media could help a lot.
I think what Bill Cosby did to humanize African Americans, middle class, and so forth, for the rest of America and the world, the same thing should be done maybe in a Muslim family in America or somewhere else. Their values, how they interact if they're in Brooklyn, how they interact with local Jewish grocer, how they interact with police, how they interact when their son is in the United States Army, how they interact with a Muslim chaplain, namely to give face and content to this entire community, which is now a category but has not become individualized.
I absolutely agree with both of those statements.
As a member of the media and CNN specifically, I take everybody's point here, but since I'm here, I think it's only fair perhaps if I can say something very briefly. Rob, sorry. It's true what you say. The problem is that we have 15 seconds, one and a half minutes to report a story. You're not going to get depth and you're not going to get context. Is that right? No, but that's the way that our news wheel turns. I certainly think that there could be a lot more responsibility in the way we portray things, and I think that's up to individual journalists. There are some very, very good journalists that do some excellent work and know these issues. It's not all of them that way. One thing that, if I may say, sitting from where I am, in terms of booking guests and getting opinions and bringing out the moderate views that you keep raising, which are the majority, they are less prone to come forward. I mean, you'd be surprised to know how hard it is for me to find the moderate voice. And in fact, I shouldn't be hunting for one, you know, but it's very, very easy. Except, well, all right. Do you know how much a satellite costs on Bahrain? But see, it's also about money, yeah? So, yes, but anyway, that's the point. So if it's easier to access and you're in our faces all the time, then it's easy to get that possible.
If I could just come in to just summarize the panel discussions, then we're going to come back, so it's not over. And I'm going to take what Zane just said as her commitment on behalf of CNN to do better. So, and I will. Well, I think today we really got down to business because we have some very concrete suggestions that were made. I'll read through them. They're going to be on the screens. And actually, I'll pass them to all of you. You could talk about them for the remaining 5 minutes or 6 minutes. The first recommendation, which is, I think, something that came out in the first question, is not just to focus on Islam. And we always get criticized here at CGI that it's always Islam and the rest of the world. We're part of that same stereotype of thinking that the problem is with Islam. I think we all have to do better. That could be our commitment. A number of suggestions about education, interfaith education at a young age in schools. There's another recommendation that comes a little bit later about perhaps engaging immigrant communities from other backgrounds, in developing curricula and educational programs in specific countries. Media, there was a recommendation about more media good stories, positive models of interfaith dialogue, and also the role of the arts, music, movies, which is precisely what we're going to talk about in our next panel. There also was, this is more of a policy issue, but easing up some of the visa restrictions, which in this country in particular have made it extremely hard to have the kind of cultural exchanges and dialogue at a time when all our political leaders are saying that it's needed. So they're going to have to face that contradiction. And then finally, one idea, which was to create a world religious organization modeled after the WTO to set terms for religious exchange, religious dialogue. That probably needs a little more digging to know exactly what it would mean, but that's what you could all talk about when you talk to each other. We got 5 minutes left. On to you.
If there's one thing, Bertrand, that you could leave people in this room with to action, to be effective in terms of promoting a greater understanding between cultures and religions and communities, what would it be?
At Carnegie Corporation, we have started a reformation of schools of journalism. We have now 11 schools. We want content rather than technique. We want educated, cultured journalists because, in my opinion, they're the most, other than librarians and teachers, they're the most important ingredients to safeguard our democracy. We need educated, cultured, prominent journalists like 1950s, and when they speak, they form public opinion rather than give short-term messages interrupted by all kinds of diseases, all kinds of disasters and others, which does not allow people to have any continuity of paying attention to importance of disease. So we're doing that. We already have five, and we started another five, and we hope to expand that two-year program in all our universities and other to bring arts and sciences and schools of journalism along with law, business, and others to give the journalists the best training and best culture that they can have.
So the people in this room, though, if they want to go away and write a check or get involved in an organization, other than sending it to Carnegie...
We don't accept money. We give money. other than that, I would say, again, I'm not advocating for everybody else. My view will be president of NYU is here, John Sexton. If he thinks journalists are most important, he should emphasize that. And making that journalists graduating in NYU, if they have a journalist, which they don't, should be the best educated. The other thing would be to have our curriculum, now No Child Left Behind, does not have social studies. And so we don't teach Americans even about their own constitution, not to mention about the rest of the world. So we have to teach cultural geography. There are actual people living behind this, so we don't rely on airline schedules to know how we jump from one city to the other, but we know what kind of people live down there as we fly over their countries.
Reverend?
Fund youth programs and adult dialogue. I think between evangelicals and Muslims, I think that's really important, number one. Madeleine Albright at our table said, hey, let's get literature for kids younger than even 10, because in her observation, look, they're forming these attitudes really early. And so organizations like Interfaith Youth Corps and others aiming at the young, cross-culturally, and younger than even college, even younger than high school, is where I think we have to go with this education, this dialogue.
Your Highness?
I would say start with yourselves. Keep your minds open. Talk to other people that you see around you and build the networks. Because if in this room we see the elites of the society, and for us the conversation's relatively easy, we need to find a way to translate it to a wider audience. And that is the real goal. Education, I would stress, is probably the most effective tool of doing that. So I would back up everything that's been said right now.
I would suggest everyone watch more CNN.
Good one.
With respect to education and using the media and to the journalistic comments that you made and the disaster video and the bombing videos, and unfortunately it's television and we need pictures, and as we say, it's that it's sexy to have that. Is it right? Not all the time, and it certainly needs the context and the background. There are many television news programs that are interested in doing more long-form documentary-type work, and are always looking to work with other organizations where they can be effective in passing messages like
I'm
that.
I'm sorry, you misunderstood me. I'm not again showing earthquakes, disasters, and so on. I'm after showing a major news. People discuss about funeral costs of your home lab, whether you have a insurance for a funeral, or whether you're using the right toothpaste and so forth. All the commercials that come after a serious discussion interrupt the sinking in one's consciousness, the importance of a news item. That's what I was talking about.
Fair enough. Well, I'd like to thank our esteemed panelists here. They've been fantastic. Thank you. And I'd like to invite Secretary Albright.
Please stay in your seats. Our program continues. Please remain in your seats.
Well, that was a terrific panel. Thank you very much, all of you. I am now going to talk about the commitments from today. So could I ask Abu Patel and Omar Amanat to come on stage, please? Very good to see you. Very good to see you.
How are you?
Very exciting to announce this project. The organizations that are involved in it are the Interfaith Youth Corps, IFYC, with the support of the James Jensen Genesis Group. And the commitment is to create a professional video that documents IFYC's exemplary year-long Interfaith Youth Leadership Exchange Program, and to really show the public the importance of interfaith youth programs around the world. And the commitment is $120,000 over 15 months. They do need a little bit more, some $40,000 to enable to fund more of the interfaith youth exchange. The video is in good shape, but they really do need some more help. I think what's terrific about this is that the documentary will highlight the experiences of youth in the Interfaith Exchange Program between Chicago's IFYC and Jordan Interfaith Action in Amman. IFYC will find the people to produce and direct the documentary and market it aggressively through media channels and broadband, and it will use the documentary within the wide range of IFYC's trainings and presentations and speeches to promote the pursuit of peaceful interfaith communities worldwide. I think in what we were talking about just now in the discussion groups, this is exactly the kind of a project that has legs, as we say. It will show the fact that the young people from Chicago and Amman doing service work in those cities, as well as the exchanges that take place, demonstrating really the power of youth as religious peace builders. I have to say, I have a very special feeling about Ebu. I met him here last summer, last fall, when we were doing this, and I'm so impressed with the kind of work they have done. So I congratulate you for this, and I look forward to talking and writing about you even more.
Thank you very much.
And I will actually give you the certificate with the paper clip. Okay. Thank you very much. The second one project that I'd like to announce, and could I invite Don Storper, the CEO and founder of Putumayo World Music, and John Marks, president, Search for Common Ground, to come up and join me.
Susan Carl Marks.
Well, what a pleasure it is. How are you? Great. And again, this fits in so well with the kinds of discussions that we were having. The organizations involved are the Putumayo World Music and Search for Common Ground. And the commitment is to promote the use of music, film, and other arts as tools to help resolve conflict around the world. And the value is at least $100,000 over 3 years. The Putumayo World Music commits to giving Search for Common Ground $1 million from every copy it sells of the CD.
$1 million.
A million. We will be out of business tomorrow.
Well, what's wrong? Okay. $1. But you're going to sell at least $1 million.
Whoa.
Okay.
That's the multiplier effect we're all looking for.
Definitely. For every copy that you sell of One World, Many Cultures, a multicultural collaboration between some of the world's leading musicians. Search for Common Ground will use this money to fund new programs that promote the arts, helping people from diverse backgrounds to build new relationships together. And in the past, Search for Common Ground has produced radio and TV dramas in a dozen countries. It holds Common Ground film festivals, makes music videos of peace songs, and has sponsored an art exchange between the U.S. and Iran. I think that there is no question that artistic collaboration between people in conflict is a way to build respect and understanding. And that both the CD and Search for Common Ground's art-based conflict resolution initiatives truly have a magical way of raising awareness about current ethnic and religious struggles. We at our discussion table, Susie was there, talked about the beginnings of what music and culture can do. It is the one thing that we really can really find some commonality on. So congratulations. I think this is a terrific initiative.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I have to say, I participated in a great event on Sunday when the Thelonious Monk jazz competition all got together, and it's so evident what a difference music can make as good ambassadors. And now the last commitment for this session is, could I ask Mrs. Heidi Hatzell, president of the Hartford Seminary, and Mr. Cornelius B. Pryor, philanthropist, to come up, please.
Thank you very much.
This is a very important activity in which Mr. Cornelius and Mrs. Gertrude Pryor are contributing, and the commitment is to endow a Jewish professorship in interfaith relations at Hartford Seminary in Connecticut. And the value is $100,000 per year for 5 years. The endowment will fund the seminary's new Building Abrahamic Partnerships program, a training program in Jewish and Christian Muslim relations. It was first launched in 2004 and is developing a new kind of religious leadership. BAP, as it is called, prepares clergy for interfaith ministry and for addressing religious diversity. The endowment will secure a professorship and will maintain the current annual enrollment goals of 30 participants drawn equally from the three faith traditions. Again, this is a very exciting program that is growing. It grew from a simple pilot to a cutting-edge training program, and it's been recognized by other seminaries as a resource for their students. I think it is a very exciting project. Hartford Seminary is the home to the oldest Christian-Muslim relations program in the United States, and it established a Jewish professorship in interfaith relations in 2003, and as I said, launched this BAP program in 2004. So again, it fits in so well with the kind of suggestions that were made during our discussion. So congratulations, and thank you very much for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.